you, Bill. Let me make a couple of remarks as we begin. First of all, when years ago, and I had become a Baptist preacher, and then in the first year of becoming a Baptist preacher after getting out of college, I came face to face with the question of universal reconciliation. And I found out that universal reconciliation was true. But one of the big problems I had still was the lake of fire and the second death, and I couldn't really see a good understanding of that. And for me, that was one of the biggest issues. I grew up in a Baptist background, heard enough hellfire preaching to know how important a part of that is to much of Christianity. And then there's also, what is death? Even that's a question in great debate. In Christianity alone, we have the view that once a person dies, they're immediately with Christ in heaven. We have the view that the dead are unconscious. We have the views of annihilation, things such as that. So there's a lot of questions here. And how can we know what the second death is if we don't know what the first death is? So it's been kind of a long road for me in coming to this. I think that all of us are kind of, or most of you that I'm familiar with, are on the same page. I just want to let you know where I am so that you can understand my viewpoint. And of course, if you disagree with my viewpoint, that's all right, but I'd just like to share with you the things that I've studied and have come to understand as being what I believe are true. I believe that death is an unconscious state, that when we die, there's no realization of anything until the resurrection. And so, in effect, what happens is once a person dies, the next conscious moment for them will be, if they're a believer, will be when Christ comes and raised in his presence. Having this, and this is a view that the Concordant Publishing Concern helped me come to, I'd like to read a paragraph from the back in the, what I've got is a hardbound copy here of the Concordant version. And on page 349, they have an Appendix A, and it deals with figures of speech. And if you have that, I'm going to read a paragraph from there. And I'm going to start about halfway down under a paragraph that is entitled, As to Fact. And here it says, it is startling to realize that much of God's word is not literally true. Some of its most precious and important statements simply cannot be taken as they stand. Oh, my phone's sliding here. God is light is not an actual fact. Literally stated, he is in the spiritual sphere in some ways like light in the physical realm. But how much more forceful and beautiful to condense all this into a short, striking sentence, even if it is not strictly correct. This should open our eyes to realize that not everything in the scriptures must be taken literally. When the Lord told his disciples that Lazarus had found repose and that he was about to wake him out of sleep, they took his words literally, which misled them. So he told them frankly that Lazarus had died. But this figure, which was not true in fact, he had foreshadowed the great truth that Lazarus' death was like taking a nap, for he would rouse him from his sleep. We should be on our guard when Scripture states that which cannot be literally true. Such words are not false, but figurative. Because the Scriptures unfold to us the metaphysical and the spiritual, for which we have no organs of perception, these are usually spoken of in terms of the physical and the material. we should expect to find many figures in God's revelation. Words used literally of things in the lower sphere, accessible to our soulish senses, are needed in a superior sense for that which belongs to a higher sphere. Now, I read this, and I'm going to say, as we say down in the South from the get-go, I have a problem with this. I think this statement that I've read is very true. But when I came to the book of Revelation, and then we come to chapter 20 and verse 10, and what takes place at the end of chapter 19, we have a beast and a false prophet thrown into a lake of fire and being tormented for the eons of the eons. And I agreed with the concordant concern on the teaching that death was an unconscious state. So how can you have a second death, which if it was the same as the first death would be an unconscious state, if they're being tormented all the time that they're there? So this was a problem. And I'm sure that it's something that has occurred to all of you also. What is hell? You ever stop and think about it? Hades is translated hell, Gehenna, and I know most of you are familiar with these terms. I'm not going to spend a long time on them. Tartarus, the lake of fire, is considered pretty much by most to be hell, or the same as hell, replacement for it. Purgatory with the Catholic Church, limbo. I attended a Methodist church once as a child, and they had a discussion on this, and they were teaching that the things that we do in our life, we create our own hell. So if we got Hades and Gehenna and Tartarus and the lake of fire and purgatory and limbo and this life, then Christianity has like seven hells. And so what is heaven? It's called paradise. It's called heaven. There's a denomination called the Universalist Unitarians, who I think I could have got along well with in the late 1800s, but they went very liberal since then and believed all kinds of things and even foreign religions. And their idea of heaven is just some sort of vague spiritual unity with God, and can't even explain. Paradise, heaven, and this nebulous unity, that's only three. Why in the world does Christianity have twice as many hells as it does heavens? It doesn't make any sense. We're supposed to have a message that is good news. To me, one of the biggest problems with understanding the lake of fire and the second death comes with the identities of who's involved in the book of Revelation. And that's the main thing I'd like us to look at tonight. What are the identities that are involved in this? When we look at the book of Revelation, John is having visions. And these visions are kind of like a cross between an animated movie and Pilgrim's Progress. You've got animals that talk and do things. Even the Lord Jesus himself doesn't appear in the same way. He comes out as there's a vision of him that's very astounding, and then we have him as the Lion of the Tribe of Judah, and then through the bulk of the book, he's the Lambkin. And then towards the end, he's a rider on a white horse. If we can't see the vision that John recorded for us the same way that John saw it, then we're probably going to miss what he meant, aren't we? And so I hope that we're going to be able to go back, and we need to understand who the characters are. Okay. me ask you some questions to think about, and then we'll get started here. Are the beast and the false prophet humans, or are they spiritual beings? Paul only speaks of two different kinds of bodies, celestial and terrestrial, so I think we're probably limited to those. Second question, are the beast and false prophet individuals or representatives of groups of people? Third question, can spirit beings be tormented in literal? The beast and false prophet, are they superhuman or supernatural beings? And the reason I ask this question, these words supernatural and superhuman don't occur in the scriptures. I need a better prop for my phone here. They don't occur in the scriptures, but in Bullinger's commentary on Revelation, and he's an annihilationist, on A. Enoch's commentary on Revelation, of course, he is a universalist in the sense who believes in the second death being literal death. J. A. Sice and R. H. Charles, well-known commentaries, and they believe in endless torment. All of these say that they're basically superhuman. And that's how they get around. They have to come up with a reason for why they can talk about these people or these identities, and I want to stick more with the word identities, why they talk about them as they do, and come to the point where I have to agree with or disagree with them. If these are human, and the lake of fire is figurative, it has to be because humans cannot endure literal fire, can they? They would soon die. You ever stop to think that if a human was in the lake of fire, in order to be tormented forever and ever, he has to be healing as fast as he is being burned? I mean, a human in just a few days can die from dehydration, and fire would greatly increase that. So we've got these non-biblical terms of superhuman in the commentaries. The number 666 is not said to be the number of a superhuman, but it's a human number. So there's several things here. And so the first thing I'd like us to think about tonight is spiritual beings and fire. Can a spiritual being be tormented in literal fire? And we have actually a surprising number of passages about this. Would like to read a few, and if you'd like to turn and follow in these passages, I'll give you references, and if not, that's fine also. But the first one will be Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. Verse 1, now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert, Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. And he said, draw not nigh hither, put off the shoes from thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Therefore he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Now, we don't actually know if this was literal fire or not, do we? it wasn't consuming the bush, and yet this spiritual being, the angel of the Lord, was in this bush, and we see him as a flame of fire. Let's turn to chapter 13 of Exodus. Exodus 13, verses 21 and 22. Exodus 13:21, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, to go by day and by night. He took not away the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night from before the people. Now here it says that Yahweh went before them in this pillar of fire by night, and in another place it's going to say angel. It's God who was leading them. Chapter 14, verses 19. Exodus 14, 19. And the angel of God which went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel, and it was a cloud and darkness to them, but it gave light by night to these, so that the one came not near the other all the night. We definitely have some questions coming up here in our minds anyway regarding spiritual beings and fire. It seems that they can actually be presented as fire, and we have verses saying this. Let me go to Deuteronomy chapter 1. Deuteronomy chapter 1. I'll get there in a minute. I had to, my old Bible's falling apart. I had to get a new one and the pages stick together. Deuteronomy 1:33. Who went in the way before you to search out the place to pitch your tents and fire by night to show you by what way you should go and in a cloud by day? You'd like a couple more verses on this, the angel in the cloud and the fire, Psalm 78:14, Psalm 105:39, Psalm 121:5-6. So those were not really sure if the fire is literal or not. But the angel seems to have the appearance of fire. Let's go to Judges 13:20, and here we have something a little different. Judges chapter 13. This is in the story about Samson. Judges 13, and we're going to look at verse 20. An angel appeared to Manoah's wife, and the husband wasn't there, so they asked for him to come back, and he did, and they tried to make a sacrifice with him. In chapter 13, verse 20, for it came to pass when the flame went up toward heaven from off the altar where they were making this sacrifice, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife looked on it and fell on their faces to the ground. Now here we have a spiritual being actually in literal fire and ascending up into heaven in this fire. And I don't think that we would think for a moment that he was actually being tormented. We have in Psalm 104, verse 4, God makes his messengers a flaming fire. And this is quoted in Hebrews 1:7. Remember Daniel. We'll go there for a minute. Chapter 3, verses 19 through 25. verse 19, "Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace seven times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because of the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, and rose up in haste, and spoke, and said unto the counselors, Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, True, O king. He answered and said, Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. For strong evidence against spiritual beings being bothered by literal fire, isn't it? And even the ability to protect the human set. In 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 11, I'll not change there, we have Elijah and Elisha were parted by a chariot of fire and horses of fire. Elijah was taken up into heaven. Elijah had called down fire from heaven on two captains and their allotment of 50 soldiers, destroyed them. And then in Revelation 13:13, the false prophet has power to call down fire from heaven. And the final verse on this, I'll turn to this one, Revelation 19:7, and this is part of a vision, so it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be taken literally. Let's see if I've got the right verse here. Instead of verse 7, it was verse 17 and 70. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with clouds of fire in the midst of heaven, Come and gather yourselves together to the great God. I've not proven the shadow of a doubt with these verses. Be tormented in literal fire, but I think we have certainly raised very good grounds where if anyone wants to say otherwise, they have to produce the proof. As far as I'm concerned, the Bible is showing us that spiritual beings cannot be tormented in literal fire. As a matter of fact, it seems like something much different from this is what would cause torment for spiritual beings. I'm going to turn to Luke 8:31. The event where Jesus and the disciples were traveling and into Gennesaret. And there was a man there that had a legion of demons. And I think you'll remember the story. I'm just kind of taking shots here and hitting verses and hoping you'll remember what goes with it. But in 8:31, and they besought him that he would not command them to go out into the deep. And let's see, there's another verse. Okay, this is where the demons request of Jesus when he's casting the legion of demons out of this man he not command them to go out into the lake or into the sea or into a submerged chaos? And then I think in Matthew it actually says, we know you, Jesus, who you are, Son of God. Are you come to torment us before the appointed time? So, you know, and then we have in Revelation chapter 20, where is it that the dragon is cast? He's cast into the bottomless pit or the submerged chaos, the same term that is used with the idea of the sea. Also, we're going to look at 2 Peter 2:4. This is kind of like Bible drill, isn't it? All over the place. 2 Peter 2:4, for if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell, which is actually Tartarus here, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. Let's see what Jude 6 says. Jude verse 6. And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. Now, if fire does anything, it brightens and lights up, doesn't it? It's a release of a lot of energy and heat and light. And yet it seems from these verses what it is that binds or torments spiritual beings is to be locked in darkness and even in water. These are ideas that come from these passages. Well, is it even possible for spiritual beings to die? Look at Luke 20, verse 36 there, which has an interesting comment for us, where Jesus was talking about the resurrection. Start at verse 34 there, Luke 20:34. And Jesus answering said unto them, the children of this world marry and are given in marriage, but they which be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither can they die any more, for they are equal unto angels and are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. So, how is it that when we're glorified, we're equal to angels? Does that mean 100% equal in every way that, as some people want to count equality? It doesn't really say that. A lot of things to think about there. We know that they are called sons of God, and we are looking forward to being sons of God and manifested as such. But this thing about death is really the key point that comes out in this verse, and I think what we can count on. And that is that the spiritual beings cannot die. So what is this lake of fire? If the beast and false prophet are spiritual beings, why are they cast into the lake of fire, while the dragon, of whom Satan is the head, goes into the abyss? This is at the beginning of the millennium, at the end of chapter 19, and we'll be looking at that vision in more detail later. But we see here a definite difference between who the beast and the false prophet are, and this is this idea of identities, and the dragon. And I think we have the dragon because it's being an animal like this, these animals are used to represent in these visions large groups. just as they were in Daniel. So, this is a one big question. Why does God put the beast and the false prophet in the lake of fire and put Satan's realm somewhere else? And that's a question that we have to be able to answer. Okay. Now we're going to really get into the identity thing. Who's in there? Has anybody got a question so far or comment before we go any further? Is it helpful to think about whether or not spiritual beings can even be tormented by fire?
When I mute that keyboard, I think it's Rosario.
Yeah, I could hear a keyboard, but it doesn't bother me too much if it doesn't bother anyone else.
It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad on the phone recording.
Okay.
No, I think very helpful. Very helpful to contemplate those questions.
Okay. Well, that's what we want to do with, because we don't want to come to the end on what the second death is and then have all these other questions looming in the background. I'm trying to help answer some questions as we go.
Yeah. All right. Back to Luke 20, 34.
Yes, sir.
He is speaking to terrestrials. Yes?
Yes.
Not to us celestials.
True.
And we are to be judging angels, according to Paul, not equal to them. Right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so he's not speaking to us there.
And that's one of the reasons I didn't want us to take the word equal as absolutely equal in every sense.
Okay.
But those who are part of the resurrection cannot die anymore, and I think the emphasis of those verses is on the spiritual beings. The angels cannot die, and neither can those in the resurrection.
Immortality. Yes.
Yeah. Do you agree with that? All right.
Oh yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, Rick, maybe I'll make a statement here you'll disagree with.
Okay.
Or maybe something to make you think anyway. I'm going to make a statement. If anybody wants to tell me I'm wrong, you go ahead and we'll look at it. John did not see Satan in his visions in Revelation. Anybody got a comment?
Well, he saw the dragon,
and that's exactly my point. And he does speak of Satan. He mentions Satan in the letters to the churches, and he identifies Satan with the dragon, or the dragon with Satan. But as John is relating his vision, and this is one thing I'd like us to kind of keep in mind, let's see what John is describing. And he sees a dragon. If we think for a moment, and we'll look at this more later, but you remember the visions that Daniel had, and we know they're very closely related to Revelation. And there's different interpretations. Some say all of these animals were empires. Some, Enoch was saying that he thought that they represented religions. And I don't care which view you want to take on that. And to me, the important thing is that we see these as masses of people. In one view, you have the lion with the wings and so forth, and this was the Babylonian Empire. And then you have the bear that's right, is up on one side, that's the Medo-Persian Empire, and the leopard with four heads, and it's, I think, the Greek Empire, and different things. And then there's some other visions, too. But in using these animals are used to represent empires and kingdoms and so forth. there's hard, we don't have so much the idea of the beast being used where it's a single individual. And I'll be in disagreement with some people on that. But let's turn to Revelation chapter 12, and we'll see there. This is really in the visions where Satan comes into play so much. And I'd like to read verses 3 through 12 there. Revelation chapter 12, verse 3. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his head. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and it cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, for she hath a place prepared of God, and they should feed her there 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast down, that old serpent, called the devil and Satan. Okay, now John, in his writing in the Gospel and also in Revelation, we'll look at this more later, but he very freely just fills in. And we might think everything he says is part of the vision, but when he says there that the dragon was cast down, then when he says that old serpent called devil and Satan, that's information he's throwing in for our benefit. He is identifying, he doesn't want us to miss the main character involved as the dragon, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Okay? But he doesn't actually see Satan as an individual spiritual being. He sees the dragon. I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, "Now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night, and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time." Now, that last verse, verse 12 there, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth or land and of the sea." I'm pointing out those two words, the land and the sea, or the earth and the sea, because in chapter 13, we're going to see those and probably why he said, "Woe to them." But then again, and we're not going to turn there right now, but in Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3, it's the dragon who is taken and locked in the bottomless pit, or the submerged chaos, however you want to translate that. Why did John see a dragon? He's got the 7 heads and 7 crowns and 10 horns. Notice the beast of the sea. If we turn to chapter 13, we're going to see the beast come up out of the sea, and it's going to have 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 crowns. It's as if it's pulling up he's pulling up out of this sea of nations, actually, this beast in his own image. The dragon represents Satan's spiritual kingdom, not just Satan alone. when the dragon is locked in the abyss, all Satan's kingdoms of angels and demons are locked up there too. And this is necessary for 1,000 years of peace. Have you ever asked yourself the question, what is the purpose of the millennium? Why would we have a rule with a rod of iron for 1,000 years with and I give my opinion on the answer, and there may be other better ones, but I believe the reason mankind's excuses. We look at our world around us, you know, has there ever been, America been in such a time of political turmoil? So many differing opinions going on. What if the world for 1,000 years, a reborn Israel with the Spirit of God in them, ruling them, judging the nations, justice being and fast, control of disease, all kinds of blessings, no war, and then at the end of it, Satan's let loose, and in almost a snap of your fingers, there's an uprising to try and destroy Jerusalem and God's people in the capital. I think it says, look, there's nothing short of having God's Spirit in each and every individual human that's ever going to get us to the final peace that we want. And I think, in my mind, that's what I believe the millennium is for. Okay. Well, so I'm going to give an identity to the dragon. I believe that the dragon is used as a figure. He's one of the characters in this animated vision that John represents, not just Satan, but with Satan as the head, also all those spiritual beings that belong in his kingdom. Revelation in this troubled time in Earth's history to come, we'll see that there will be special nations that are under his control also. All right, any comments on Satan before we look at the wild beast?
Hey, Phil.
Yeah.
In Revelation 12:9, right, if we take the word devil and the word Satan, and rather than using it that way, use what the words actually mean. That would read like this.
Yeah.
The great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called slanderer and adversary, which deceived the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him.
Concordant version, which is a little better there, and then I started in the Old Testament and I didn't have all that, but that's very good. But definitely the accuser and slanderer are ideas that go together.
Right. I think too that if we look at it that way, then the dragon isn't necessarily Satan either in that passage. I think the translation here gives the impression that that's who it is, but it says they're called this. It doesn't necessarily mean the name. He's calling them
right.
The accuser or slanderer and the adversary.
Okay. Good, thank you. Any more thoughts or comments? 16, verse 1, it says, and it, and when it says it, it's referring to the dragon, was standing on the sand of the sea, and I perceived a wild beast descending out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns 10 diadems, and on its heads blasphemous names. And the wild beast which I perceived was like a leopardess, and its feet were as a bear's, and its mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gives it its power and its throne and great authority. Now, if we think for a moment there, we have all the characteristics. It said there in the end of chapter 12 that Satan was cast down to the earth, and he was very angry, and his time was short. Back in Daniel, we have these different empires and so forth represented by these animals, and they're going through a progression in time. But here we seem to see all of the characteristics of these previous kingdoms all compressed into one figure. Anyway, that's kind of what I think of it. And the authority, and as we remember the temptation of Christ and Satan talking about he had all of the kingdoms of this world and so forth. We have another description of this beast in chapter 17, and I'd like to turn over there just for a moment and look at a few verses. I'm not going to read all but a few lines from a few verses, because I think it clearly helps us see what the consistency of this beast is. Revelation 17, verse 9, mind which has wisdom, the seven heads where the woman is sitting, which was Babylon the Great, and they are seven kings. So there are seven kings, which has the idea going with it of seven kingdoms, as part of the makeup of this beast. And then if we drop down to verse 12 of chapter 17, party has power with the wild beast. These have one opinion and are giving. Or potentially 17 kingdoms that are in this one group, which is making up the beast. And then in verse 15, and he is saying to me, these waters, which is where the prostitute is sitting, are peoples and throngs and nations and languages. Okay. I think, to me, in my mind anyway, it's very clear that this wild beast is a confederation of kingdoms to the world. I think it's a distinction, but we do have 17. There's other comments about another king with a deadly wound that was healed and so forth, but what this wild beast is made up of, like those beasts in Daniel, it's a confederation of kingdoms. It is. Okay. Now, that's really all I want to hit on the identity of the wild beast, but I want to make a comparison now. I'd like you to look at chapter 13, verse 1, and be able to flip over and look at chapter 14, verse 1, because I think this will help us get a little bit of a feel for what's going to be taking place in the book. In chapter 13, and it, the dragon, was standing on the sand of the sea. Chapter 14, verse 1, and I perceived, and lo, the lambkin standing on Mount Zion. Chapter 13, verse 1, and I perceived a wild beast descending out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns 10 diadems, 14 ones, and with it and with the Lamb, 144,000 have. And then I'll go ahead here, having its name and the Father's name written on their foreheads. And back to 13:1, and on its heads, blasphemous names. You see how parallel these are. We have on one hand the dragon, and on the other hand, the Lamb. And then we have the 17 kings, or however you want to describe the heads and the horns and so forth, and we have the 144,000. And then we have on the dragon's side the blasphemous names, and then on the other side with the Lamb, they have the Lamb's name and the Father's name on their foreheads. And so we have a very direct comparison here. We have the two opposing sides. We have the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And the big battle is coming to a close. So this is where I want to kind of wrap up on the wild beast. If there's any comments or questions, be glad to share those now, but mainly my main point here is I want to see that this beast is very much like the book of Daniel in that it's representing a confederation of under Satan's authority, a group of countries that are united together for this purpose. Any comments or questions?
To sum up what you were saying, Revelation 12, speaking of the dragon, speaking of a spiritual kingdom.
Right.
Revelation 13, the wild beast, speaking of physical kingdoms, human kingdoms that are influenced spiritual. I have that right so far.
That's right. Right. That's exactly how I advise be understood.
Okay.
That's how I understand it.
That's okay. And then 13:1 and 14:1 is comparing the two opposite sides.
Right.
That's good so far.
I think the 13:1 and 14:1 kind of help put the whole thing in perspective, because we know that there's a great battle coming, and it lines them up.
Hey, Bill, we're going
to, yes, go ahead.
Do you see, I know you see the beast is a confederation of kings. Do you also see the beast as a single figurehead along with that?
He can be spoken of as the single figurehead. There's a leader there, and I think it's probably in one place, the leader that, if we want to call it Antichrist, we can. I feel like the big problem for me,
the man of lawlessness, too.
Right. If you look at A. E. Knox's commentary on chapter 13, he mentions that this is a bunch of that this is a group of kingdoms. But almost as fast as he can, he goes to the man of lawlessness, and he spends more time explaining chapter 13 of Revelation in Paul's epistles than he does in Revelation. Bollinger does the same thing. These others do too. And I think we're predisposed to that. If we look in the Old Testament, I can show you where it says that David built the wall of the city from such a place on around the corner to another place. Well, David never picked up a stone or a trowel or anything.
Right.
He was the king and ordered it to be done.
Right.
And it's kind of that way with this. John is able to speak of the leadership of the beast, but what he's actually seeing is the beast in these visions, and it doesn't change who the beast is. It definitely does have leaders, but it's still a multiplicity of people.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Yep. Okay, that's my take on that.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. All right, then, let's talk about the beast out of the land. And this beast gets a special name because it describes his office. And this is the false prophet. I think we'll probably wrap up with this one tonight. I didn't realize I talked so long already. But we need to have a good idea on these characters. In chapter 13, verse 11, "And I perceived another wild beast ascending out of the land, and it had two horns like a lambkin's, and it spoke as a dragon, and it is exercising all the authority of the first beast in its sight, and making the earth and those dwelling in it to be worshiping the first wild beast, whose death blow was cured." Okay, and he was doing great signs and so forth. I think it's important for us to see that this is also a beast, and as such, I believe representing a multiplicity of people, as we have the two horns. Why does it have two horns? The ten horns in the previous beast were kings and so forth. So we have a couple of people here, and this beast does some very interesting things. I'd like us to get the identity of this as the false prophet. If we turn to chapter 16 and verse 13 there, we'll see him again. Chapter 16, verse 13, "And I perceived out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the wild beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits, as if they are spirits of demons doing signs, and they are going out to the kings of the whole inhabited earth." Now here's a distinction. We had 17 kings in the first beast, and we have two horns, or two leaders, in this beast out of the land, called the false prophet. But they are sending four spirits out to the other kings of the world. I've been going over a lot of questions with Tony Nungesser in an ongoing debate we have on the second death, and he can't see that there's more nations outside of the beast and the false prophet. But we have this false prophet defined, really, in chapter 19, verse 20. Chapter 19, verse 20. "And this is after the great battle, and the wild beast is arrested, and with it the false prophet, who does the signs in its sight, by which he deceives those getting the emblem of the wild beast, and those worshiping its image." Now that definition takes us back to chapter 13, as we read there. "The one with the two horns and spoke as a dragon. It's exercising all the authority of the first wild beast in its sight, and making the earth and those dwelling in it to be worshiping the first wild beast, whose death blow was cured." So the false prophet is a beast also, but it is a beast out of the land. Why two horns? It's doing a couple things. It's causing the world to worship this kingdom, more or less, with its figurehead. And causing worship is a priestly function. And then he's performing miracles, which thinks takes us to the idea of the prophet. So the two horns on this beast, I think, represent some offices of like priest and prophet under the dragon's kingdom. He's controlling commerce on a global scale, doing so many things. Without the mark of the beast, no one could buy or sell or anything else. So like the first wild beast, this one out of the land, and I believe it's out of the land of Israel, is also human. And the character of the wild beast is opposed to that of the lambkin. Now, I'd like to try and make another comparison, and then we'll close up tonight on that. I'd like to use these verses here in 13, and then also go back to chapter 11. So maybe you'd like to stick a finger in there at the beginning of chapter 11, and then also in chapter 13. In 13:11, there's two horns like a lambkin's horns. In chapter 11, verse 3, there's two witnesses, which are also olive trees and lampstands. Now, in chapter 13, verse 11, the false prophet spoke as a dragon. Chapter 11, verse 3, the two witnesses prophesy. In chapter 13, verse 12, the false prophet exercises his authority, or the authority of the first beast, in its sight. The idea of being right there before it. And these two witnesses, they stand before the Lord of all the earth, and they have authority from God for signs. In 13:13, the false beast is doing signs, fire from heaven. In 11:5, the two witnesses, fire comes out of their mouth. In 13:15, in false prophet, non-worshippers were to be killed. In 11:5, the two witnesses, anyone wanting to injure them, was to be killed. So, I'm drawing another comparison here so we can see between the two witnesses and this beast out of the land with the two horns. And I'm going to make a little bit of a conclusion here. So why are the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the land segregated for the 1,000 years from the dragon? And I'm going to say it's because they are a different kind of being. The dragon represents Satan and his angels, and these beasts are under Satan's authority, definitely, but they are humans and on the earth. And this has a lot to do with why, in my understanding, the lake of fire is figurative and not literal, because humans could not be tormented for more than 1,000 years in literal fire. Now, next week, we'll talk about the great prostitute, and we'll compare her with the New Jerusalem. And we'll see, we'll get some details kind of cleared up on this and move ahead from there. Anybody got any comments or questions here before we wrap it up?
I thought that was a very good presentation, Phil. Anybody that's listening, and hopefully they were taking notes, definitely have a lot of things to look through and to consider. And I think the main thing that we have to realize is anytime that we're hearing something for maybe the first time or haven't considered, You can't just dismiss something without hearing all the aspects of it and then doing your due diligence to compare it with other scriptures to see if it's so. And I think unfortunately, like you said earlier, a lot of us are preconditioned to think a certain way. So when we hear something that seems to run counter to that, the first thing that happens is we start to tune that other view out, and we're already formulating in our mind our response to it. And I come from a similar background as you, and a lot of those same issues that you were struggling with were ones I was struggling with. And I've come to a lot of the same conclusions independently that you're laying out tonight. That was, you know, in what you did is add in more information for me, and that's always a good thing.
Well, good. I think we need to specify or then from I think things start to fall into place. So I realize this is really preliminary and anything about death, but I feel like for me this was an important step to get there.
Right. And it's like anything else, Phil, you know, you have to have background information to fully understand any subject.
Yeah.
And without that information, you can talk about a subject all you want to, but people just will not understand it without that information.
Yep. I agree.
Very good.
Hey, Phil.
Yeah.
What you're saying goes along with the, in my opinion, the parable in Matthew 13 with the darnel.
Yes.
Because those are a confederation of nations, the goats that are cast into the fiery Ionia.
Yep.
Now, it's not called the lake of fire there, but it's the same.
In my opinion, it's very much the same. And we'll also look at Matthew 25.
Yeah.
In relationship to this too.
Yeah.
Good. Any other questions? We'll tell you what to do. Put in review your notes during the week, and as you're reviewing your notes, check questions you may have.
Yeah.
I'm fine taking a few minutes to answer those.
I'd be glad to try and answer them. I don't know that I have all the answers. Give an opinion anyway.
Very good. Well, on that note, John, did you want to close us?
Sure.